Everybody, my name is Toby. It's good to be with you this morning. This past week, we were a family, and I and our friend and guest Lindsay were up in the northern part of Ontario near Algonquin, and a few months ago, as she was planning her visit, you know, she's from the UK, and we actually got to know her in Tanzania, and she said, "Oh man, I really want to see Canada, you know, especially like the wild, like, you know, what she thought of as Canada." And we thought, yeah, we'd do that, right? And so we began to frantically a little bit like, okay, let's, you know, we realized neither of us had actually been to the Algonquin. We don't know what we're supposed to do there. Started doing all this research, and then a deep desire welled up in me to see a moose. I was like, oh man, yeah, like, yeah, wearing my Canadian shirt here. Moose, by the way, the plural of moose is not meese. We had to look this up. It's actually just moose. It's moose. That's what Google told me, okay? But suddenly I felt this, like, I felt more Canadian in a way. And maybe that's because, you know, as can many of us who are Canadians, there aren't so many kind of foundational stories that we hang on to, right? Like, besides saying sorry and drinking Tim Hortons, like, we don't have, like, those, you know, real foundational stories that we tell and retell to know that we're Canadian. At least I don't know many of them. Maybe that's the case. But, you know, as we have been in the book of Acts, which a series we're calling Origins, this is really a foundational family story. If you are here and you are a Christ follower, if you are a Christian, this is our family history. And maybe you have your own, you know, there must be so many family histories represented in this room. And we know more or less of them to a varying degree. But this is the important one. Like, there's one of our national identity, and then there's our family history. Maybe even in your history, you have a family crest or something like that, or you have a family tree, or you have a book, and you can look back at generations and generations. But this story, these stories here, especially in Acts, are so foundational. I was thinking, this is the story that I want my kids to know. This is the family history that I want my kids to learn and to know. Thanks, Judah. And so we're going to be in a few verses in chapter 8. If you've been with us for a little while, you might be thinking, are we still here? Are we still? When do we start this? In the very beginning of the book of Acts, Jesus says, you're going to be my witnesses in Jerusalem. So this local, where we are now, in the area, Judea and Samaria, so outer, and then in the ends of the earth. And that kind of becomes a bit of a table of contents in the Acts. And we've actually just been in the Jerusalem section. So all seven chapters, really locally, it's happening in Jerusalem in the first few years of the church. And actually now, at this point, we're moving out. We're moving out. And We've read some of these verses before, actually, in the last few weeks, but we're going to just pause here and kind of stop and see what it has to say for us. It says, "And Saul approved of his execution." That's Stephen, who gave this great speech and sermon. He was then stoned to death. "And there arose on that day a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem. And they were all scattered throughout the region of Judea and Samaria." There's that. Luke is telling us, okay, yep, we're moving outwards, Judea and Samaria, "except the apostles. Devout men buried Stephen and made great lamentation over him. But Saul," who we later know as Paul, the Apostle Paul, "this Saul was ravaging the church. And entering house after house, he dragged off men and women and committed them to prison." Maybe it's the fact that it's a book, and maybe the Bible feels a little distant from us, but what's happening here is chaos, is violence. there's a great persecution. It says Saul was ravaging the church. Later in a letter to Galatians, said, I violently persecuted Christians. That's what Saul said. And some commentators note the fact that he dragged off men and women, the fact that he was indiscriminate, that he took both men and women to prison, was something of note. He was zealous for God and to eradicate this group of people following this Jesus. We kind of miss that. Recently, I've been really, for whatever reason, interested in World War history. Maybe because it feels for me personally, it feels a little distant. And maybe in this room we have different touch points to that, but it feels so far away. We know there are effects of it, but yet, you know, it feels so far away. I remember my grandmother I was a lot younger. She remember telling me about, you know, she was in Hong Kong and she was, you know, hiding from the Japanese. And I just couldn't compute that. And I had to actually look up later recently, you know, there was this battle in Hong Kong. And so there in a way there's a lot of history behind us that is violent, that is cruel, that where people fought tooth and nail for to survive. And maybe because we're here today, we're like, okay, there was already a happy ending there. But actually, in the moment, it's absolute and utter chaos. But perhaps the believers here weren't surprised by this. Maybe they weren't. In Luke chapter 9, Jesus is speaking to his disciples. Peter has just confessed that he is the Christ. That's what he says. You are Christ. You are the Christ of God. And he gathers them and he says, guys, I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be put to death. And they don't get it. And then he says this. And if you are a Christian here, this is one of those like scary verses that we should, you know, you kind of skim over a little bit. This is what Jesus says. He says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. Scary fact number one. We as a people, as a generation right now in the year 2018, have the ability to gain the whole world. Like I try to tell my kids at the right moment, we live like better than most kings did in the history of the world. We can literally, if we want to save up a little bit, travel the world. You could do that in your lifetime. You could taste the world, maybe even Toronto, but you can do that. We can experience so much. We are at a point where this tempt, you know, it must have been true in Jesus' time when he said you could gain the whole world but lose your life. But how much truer of it is for us today? That we could gain the whole world, that we can gain all these things, but actually miss the point completely. Scary fact number two, Jesus says, whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him I will be ashamed of. See, most of us probably won't be like that in Acts chapter 8. We won't be running for our lives, probably not. But many of us will come to moments and situations where we can either speak for Jesus or be ashamed of Jesus. And the degree to which you are not ashamed or ashamed tells you about your allegiance to Jesus. Almost 20 years ago, John Piper preached a sermon called Don't Waste Your Life. I don't know if you've ever come across that book or that sermon. He preached it in the year 2000 to 40,000 students, college students. Jesus is the original person who said, don't waste your life. Don't waste your life. Some of us, I think the point is not to fly ourselves to a country where all Christians are persecuted and maybe that's where we'll flourish. I don't think that's the point. But I do think many of us are waiting. We're waiting for, you know, getting beyond this stage, and then I'll really follow Jesus. You know, when I'm in a different phase of my life and my kids are out of it, then I'll do some missions, whatever that looks like. You know, when I get that promotion or whatever, then I'll start tithing and giving, and we're waiting, and we're waiting, and we're waiting. And yet when we look back at our family history, we can see it was actually born out of chaos. They were in Jerusalem. And who knows how long they would have stayed if this didn't happen. And yet in the chaos, in the persecution, they were pushed out. And they pushed outward, finally, into mission. We're going to move on into verse 4 and verse 8. So we were reading verse 3. And so what does this look like? Luke, the writer, he tells us about what happened. He says, now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. Philip went down to the city of Samaria and proclaimed to them the Christ. And the crowds with one accord paid attention to what was being said by Philip when they heard him and saw the signs that he did. For unclean spirits crying out with a loud voice came out of many who had them, and many who were paralyzed or lame were healed. So there was much joy in that city. I want you to put your imagining caps on right now. Just, we're going to do a little exercise. I don't know about you. When we drive to church in the morning, we come, we're kind of coming south on Church Street, and we've done this enough where someone will say, oh, look, I see the church. I don't know where you come from, you know, the steeple of St. Francis. I want you to imagine for a moment that this doesn't exist. Picture a grassy field, maybe. Imagine, in fact, there are no churches. Recently, I drove, just a few weeks ago, we were down Rosslyn, and I didn't realize how many churches there are. But just for imagine whatever is coming to your mind when you think of church, picture it not there. Picture a plaza, picture a park, nothing. Now, imagine that as a group of us, we were actually living in downtown Toronto. And for a few years, we have been together with just a few thousand other people, and we have been following this man called Jesus, who died and resurrected. Some of us here actually witnessed it. We were there when he was crucified. Some of us perhaps saw him resurrected. And it has been the time of our lives. It has been absolutely amazing. We didn't know life and community could be this good. But just a few days ago, right in front of City Hall in that bright Toronto sign, one of our best and brightest, Stephen, he was stoned to death. He died. And suddenly our world is completely rocked. We don't know what to do. And we begin to run and scatter for our own lives. Some go west to Peel and Mississauga. Maybe some of us have family in Niagara. Maybe some of us, you know, go back north. We actually had come from the north, maybe Newmarket or beyond Barrie, and we start kind of just heading back home. Some of us find ourselves east into this area right here, Pickering Village. Here's the question. What do you do? What do you do? This is the situation. There's no safety of a church building or even a sense of perhaps yet what it looks like to be a people of God not gathered in Jerusalem. What does that even look like? We've done that for a few years, but now what? This is the situation that Philip finds himself in, that all these new disciples find themselves in. And I would say, well, maybe I'd give you the Bible, okay? Like, here you are, you're landed here, and you have a Bible in a new city, no church, no believers. What do you do? I don't think they even had that, actually. This is what Luke tells us they did. In verse 4, now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. And we're going to double-click on preaching the word. What does that mean? And then specifically he says, Philip went down to the city of Samaria and proclaimed to them the Christ. The Christ. What does that mean? Our four-year-old son, Isaiah, has been asking a lot of questions. And in the chaos of whatever our life is, it's like his voice just comes out and he just asks these often phenomenal questions. Like, so often, they've been very theological even. He'll say, why does God love us? This little guy. Or he'll ask, how did God make God? We're like, oh, man. Here are some words I never thought I'd say in church. He said, does God have a penis? Jesus had a penis, yeah, has a penis. But see, some of them are theological and puzzling. We will take that out of the recording. I'm sure I will do that. But then there are some that are actually plain and simple, but that are still hard. Like when we were outdoors in nature this week, he said, what is nature? I was like, outside, I guess. Outside and not made. You know, it's like, it's hard. You know what? Because it's like these are just normal words that we presume and that we know, and he's asking for a definition. And these words that we're going to double-click on, gospel and Christ, maybe they are just normal. They're words to you that just instantly fill, you know, you have a filled definition of what it is. Oh, yeah, gospel, Christ. Gospel, Christ. He says, those who were scattered went about preaching the word. That in the Greek is actually just one word. It's a verb that encapsulates it. It's like evangelizing or gospeling. That's what Luke says everyone began to do. Gospeling. What does that look like? We have gospel music. We have gospel choir. You know, like, we have so many gospel things. We talk about being gospel-centered. What does that even mean? A few weeks ago at the Waypoint, someone came in and we were just chatting, and he had, you know, often people kind of get to, like, okay, if you're a church, okay, they'll say, what kind of church are you? And I began to explain, well, we are, you know, broadly a Protestant evangelical church. And he said, well, what is that? I was like, huh, yeah. And he had some idea of, like, the Catholic Church, but had absolutely no knowledge of the Protestant Reformation. So I had to, like, start there. But then when I had to explain evangelical, I was kind of like, well, you know, it's like this movement of people, me in the last, especially 100 years or so, like, you know, Billy Graham, right? Like, you know, he's evangelical. Like, we honor, we worship Jesus, and we believe in the Bible, you know. But actually, what does that word mean? What does the word gospel and evangelical mean? What does it mean they were gospeling the word? I've been fascinated with this inscription that was made, and scholars have found this. This was found in, I believe, 9 BC, 9 years before Christ. This inscription is dated to, and let me just read it, and you'll get a sense of what it's talking about. Whereas the providence which has regulated our whole existence has brought our life to the climax of perfection in giving to us the Emperor Augustus. So this is Caesar Augustus. He was on the throne when Jesus was born. Who being sent to us and our descendants as Savior has put an end to war and has set all things in order. Next slide. And whereas having become God manifest, Caesar has fulfilled all the hopes of earlier times. The birthday, this is celebrating the birth of Caesar, of the God Augustus has been for the whole world the beginning of good news concerning him. So gospel meant something immediately to our first century family because they were living in a Roman world with a Roman emperor who was not just king, but son of God. A king who was born of God and who brought good news. This good news was used more generally of just a battle or a decisive decision that was made and that had implications on a city. It was like, this is the good news. A battle is won, and this is the good news. Caesar is king, whatever that may be. That's what the gospel means in this context. A battle is won, and now there is good news. But it isn't just in that first century Greco-Roman context. If we then double-click on that word, Christ. Would you believe that Christ appears in the New Testament over 500 times? If you thought that was Jesus' last name, that's okay. I think that's fair. You know, Joseph Christ, Mary Christ, Jesus Christ, right? Like that doesn't make sense in some way. What does Christ mean? They use it over and over and over again. It's the word that means anointed one. It's that Greek word, but it comes actually all the way from the story of Israel, where they anointed their kings. King Saul was anointed with oil. King David anointed with oil. And if you read in Samuel, anointed just becomes shorthand for the king. I wouldn't do that to the anointed one, the king. And this is a huge, huge part of the story that we have to see. I want you to think of the Old Testament as in a sense, often it zooms in on somebody, and then it zooms back out. It zooms back in, and it zooms back out. So right in the very first chapters of the Bible, in Genesis, we zoom in. We zoom in on Adam. And Adam and Eve, what are they called to do? They're called to actually reign and rule. But that breaks up, that goes to bits and pieces. You read the first 11 chapters of the Bible, and it actually reads more like a horror story. It's terrible. We zoom out, and it's awful. And finally, in chapter 12, we zoom in again. We zoom into Abraham, and God says, okay, I'm going to pick you now, Abraham, to be the promise. And so then in Abraham, we zoom back out. The people of Israel come out of his family. They are oppressed in Egypt, of course. And then we zoom in to this prophet Moses, this great leader Moses. And in Deuteronomy, he says, there is going to be actually a prophet like me who will come. But when we zoom back out, we see that it doesn't go well again. All through Judges, people were just doing whatever they wanted. Until in Samuel, we zoom in on this desire for a king. They have this strong desire. They said, Samuel, please give us a king. Give us a king. And so we zoom in finally on David. And David is this great king. He has many, many flaws. But out of David, there's this promise. There's going to be a king just like David. And as we zoom out, we start looking at his family line. We look at Solomon and all the kings that will come. And we're kind of asking, okay, is this the king? Is this the king? Is this the king? And it's Isaiah, I think, who the whole book of Isaiah, which is a massive book, but is all about this question, who is the king? Who is the king? Who is going to be our leader? Because it's not going to be Hezekiah. Hezekiah fails, right? And then in the latter half of the book of Isaiah, I just want to read a few verses to you. As we have this question, okay, who's the king? Who's the king? Isaiah chapter 40, verse 10, behold, The Lord comes with might, and his arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense is before him. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom and gently lead those that are with young. There's a sense, okay, actually, the king is actually going to be God somehow. How's this working? God is coming. God is coming. And then later, all throughout Isaiah, but specifically, let me read for you from Isaiah 42. What is this king going to be like? Look, behold, my servant, this king's going to be a servant whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. It keeps going. This king's going to be like a servant serving. And then Isaiah 61 says this. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance for our God, to comfort all who mourn. If you are bored with the Old Testament, let me tell you, there is a longing coming out of the Old Testament for a promised king who then is also divine and yet a servant. And that's all captured in this word, Christ. Maybe it's better for us today to see Christ and say King. Christ, the divine, long-awaited, promised king. See, that's, in a word, is what Philip did. And if you would read on in chapter 8, that's what he does. There's a king. There's a king, and he's come, and he's here to rule. His kingdom has begun. So here's the question. How do we do this? How do we talk about the king? I think, first of all, it means that we have to be really good listeners. We have to be really good when we're in conversations, when we're absorbing media, when we're sitting down having a coffee, to hear how there is still, I think today, a longing in our friends and neighbors for a king, for someone to rule. And I think it comes out in so many different ways, like the way we talk about our political leaders. I mean, do you remember when Obama was coming through? I mean, the sense of hope and the desire to just, like, yeah, this man, he's going to be a man of hope, and we're going to put our hope in this man. And maybe it comes out negatively today and in some of our leaders, but there's this longing and desire. I think even of the royal wedding. I mean, think about how much attention that the whole world turned to, and his kingdom is, or he's like, what is he, the Duke of Sussex, which I think is smaller than God's kingdom, right? And yet we desire, we're like, man, we so long for it. When you listen to your friends and families and neighbors, where is that desire? Maybe it's when you're watching the Avengers with them, and it's our longing for like a hero to save us and not die, or whatever that is. I think there's ways we can talk about Christ the King. Christ the King. And when we do that, we can be sure and we can know that God's going to work. Because what happens after this is, not only does the people respond in Samaria, and the fascinating thing is Samaritans, if you have any kind of biblical history, you know they were enemies. Jews and Samaritans, they hate each other. And here, yet Philip is at the heart of this enemy territory. He proclaims to them that Christ is the king. He says the Messiah. And actually the Samaritans actually had that in common. They were waiting for a Messiah. And Philip, this Jew, this probably this Hellenistic Jew, comes to the main city of Samaria and says, "Guys, I got it. He's here. Christ the King. He has risen indeed." And they respond. And you know what happens? There's healing. There's people who are lame, but then who find healing. The spirits are cast out. We need to expect that. I missed our discussion this week in small groups. I heard, I don't know how it was in your small groups, as you talked about this uncomfortable nature of supernatural power, but it's there, guys. It's there. There is the ability, because God is God and the Holy Spirit is God, to heal supernaturally. It may not work out that way. It may work out that we slowly and carefully walk with people and counsel them and disciple them to bring them towards healing. It might not be that we just lay our hands and boom, like, you know, the diseases. It may not be like that, but it can happen. And not only can it happen, God's power is manifest through that. And we should expect that when we preach Christ the King, the long-awaited promised King, that something's going to happen. Because he is King of the whole universe. We were singing about that today. He is King over all. Recently, we've been listening to, on our road trip, we listened to The Horse and His Boy. The Horse and His Boy was written by C.S. Lewis. It actually is the book that follows chronologically The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which you might be familiar with. And in it, the kind of the group, the antagonist, this group, they're called the Calormen. The Calormen. And it's interesting, as you hear their speech and dialogue, often from someone of a superior rank speaking to a servant or someone below them, that person would say, "To hear is to obey. To hear is to obey." Right? Why would they say that? It's because that person is of a superior rank. They could kill you. They could do harm to you. So the response is then to hear is to obey, because you know I don't want to get in trouble. I'll do what you say. To hear is to obey. As citizens of God's kingdom, He does not rule it over us with brute force and power. Only in Jesus, this king, was his crown actually not of gold or platinum or silver. It was a crown of thorns. His royal wedding was to submit his will to the Father. That night before he was betrayed at Gethsemane, he poured out his soul. And then the ceremony, as we sang, was upon this hill that he created. And his great victory was dying on a cross. That's the king we worship. And so we can come to him and say, "Lord, what is it you want me to do? Where is it do you want me to go? What is it you want me to say? I will not be ashamed. I will not be ashamed." And if you're not good at philosophical debates and apologetics, I mean, those are good things. Those are really good things. But I think part of seeing Jesus Christ as King is actually just knowing that all we need to do is talk about a person. That's one of the things Ryan, who spoke last week, one of the things I've enjoyed about getting to know him is Ryan will just say, "I love talking about Jesus." Do you agree with that? Do you sense that in your heart? Do you do that? I can't help but talk about this Jesus, who is this promise-awaited King. I was listening to a scholar lecture. His name's N.T. Wright, and he just told this story. Someone had asked him, he said, kind of puzzling, like, "So you believe and worship a first century Jewish man?" And N.T. Wright said, "Yes, I do." Friends, there is no other reason for us to be here than to worship a first century Palestinian Jewish man who claimed to be king and then died a horrible death on a cross, but then rose to life. Guys, that's why we're here. That's the only reason why we're here. If we were here to play baseball, we should pick a better time. If we're here to crochet, I don't know what would happen. Okay, there's a lot of things that we could do otherwise and gather. But the reason why we gather in this moment is because of this king. You know, all over the world, strong, powerful images are put forth for kings. And it's true even in Israel. The lion, the tribe of the Lion of Judah, the scepter will be on it. This is another promise, a longing right out of Genesis, a lion. But yet as we gather in a few moments before the bread and the wine, Jesus said, yeah, I am lion, but I am lamb. This lamb before you, this festival that you've celebrated your entire life, actually, and that has been celebrated for thousands of years, that's been pointing to me. I'm the lion, but I am the lamb. My body was broken for you. My blood will be poured out for you. I think a lot of us, you know, think, well, king, you know, the language of kings and queens is like, it's either like kind of fairy tale-ish, like it's a bit far from us, or else we think of the oppression of kings and tyrants in our world today. And we can point to some. But this king that we've been singing about, this king that calls us out and calls us forward to invite others to experience his kingdom and his goodness, he died for us. And the degree to which he said to his disciples, take up your cross, follow me, he did it first. He did it first. We can't beat him. And to the degree that you are suffering right now, maybe you feel like in this chaos of my life, I can't manage and I can't handle it, is perhaps God and Jesus the King actually calling you forward. No, come, follow me. Follow me. And it's really the echo and refrain, I think, that Edwina spoke about 2 weeks ago, that Ryan spoke about last week. Do you know him? Do you know him? Come to him. Know him. Get to know him. We're going to take the elements now. I'm going to invite you guys to come. I think we'll just be coming forward here and to remember this king who is lion, who is lamb. Would you, if you are a believer, if you are a Christ follower, if you are a citizen of the kingdom, please come. You are welcome. Take the bread. Take the wine. Could you hang on to it? Have some time of prayer, and then I'll guide us as we take that in together. All right? Let's do that.